Hello, and welcome back to the West Photo podcast, produced from the West Photo office in the University of Westminster's School of Arts. My name is Luke Herlock, and this episode was recorded and edited by Ludovica Colatino. Ludovica is a Westminster alumni and current MA writing student at the Royal College of Art. This episode features Susan Aldworth. Susan is a visual artist living and working in London. She is an associate lecturer on the Art and Science MA at Central St Martins. She's an experimental printmaker and filmmaker with a strong interest in investigating the workings of the human mind. Aldworth's practice has included exhibitions, residencies and commissions nationally and internationally. Her work is held in many public and private collections, including the V&A, the British Museum and the Wellcome Collection. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy the podcast.
So first of all, thank you so much, and I guess I would like to start by asking you to introduce yourself, like to describe your practice and where does this creative process begin?
Okay, my name's Susan Aldworth. I'm an artist who's interested in human consciousness, our sense of self, what makes us us, and our relationship between our bodies and our brains and our sense of who we are. So I explore this through working with doctors or with neuroscientists or even philosophers. It depends who are asking the questions I want to answer. And I'm a printmaker and a filmmaker, and I make installations. And each body of work I make responds to a question. I'm driven by curiosity. I'm driven by research in many ways. I start off by identifying a question or an area I want to explore, and then I find some collaborators in terms of scientists or doctors or patients that I want to talk to. And when I've done my research, I then start dreaming and I disappear in the studio. And it's not illustration, it's not literal. I hope my work's quite poetic, but it always comes out of some sort of interdisciplinary exploration to do with the human condition.
So would you say that it would be possible to understand the works of the human mind by looking at the body in some way, in the way that you do?
I'm not sure anyone understands the workings of the human mind. They're very, very complicated. The way I break it down is to a bit like scientists, I tend to focus on a particular condition, be it schizophrenia, be it consciousness, be it sleep, be it epilepsy. And working with the neuroscience that begins to understand those conditions in the human body helps me understand the sort of complete picture, because we're all on a spectrum. So when you talk about people with epilepsy, it's not very different from you and me. It's just that maybe when I don't like sunshine in my eyes, I don't fit, but someone else might. And again, with schizophrenia and hearing voices, we all have voices in our heads in terms of a very internal dialogue that goes on a lot of the time. It's just that I think my internal dialogue is with myself. I don't think there's someone else talking to me. So I think that understanding that human experience is on a spectrum and that we're all embodied creatures, our brains and our feelings, and they've even found that in your stomach you have some sort of neurons. We're such a total outfit as a body that the sort of Descartesian distinction between mind and body, although it's very attractive, it just doesn't make sense.
I would say that looking at your work feels like witnessing an ode to the biochemical machine that the body is in its perfection and the way that it works. And I was wondering, do you look much at yourself through your art?
No. I am not in the slightest bit interested in any sort of self-portraiture. I think it's vain and shallow for artists to do that. But that's just my opinion. But I am a human being. I have a human body. So I use empathy. I look to understanding experience in other people. So if I'm looking at a medical condition, for instance, at the moment, I'm just finishing off a project on sleep. And sleep is it's a universal thing. If we don't sleep, we die or go mad, or go mad first and then die. But it's someone's sleep. So although it's a sort of philosophical and a medical thing, it's very important to me not only to talk to doctors and scientists about what they think sleep is, but to talk to people. I did a big exhibition about sleep last year called The Dark Self. And in that exhibition, I tried to think about sleep because it's a nothingness. So that's why I call it the dark self. You can't see sleep. You can feel it. You can't will yourself to sleep. You have to fall asleep. It's a slippery subject. So in that exhibition, I focused on the pillow as a metaphor for sleep, because most sleep takes place in a bed and you put your head on a pillow. And I do think, although it is the whole body that falls asleep, it very much feels to me as if it's my brain falling asleep. And so I thought that indent in the pillow was to me the sort of poetry of sleep. And so I made a lot of my work around that. And then I got 414 members of the public to embroider their dreams and thoughts about sleep onto pillowcases and hung them as a big installation in the centre of the exhibition. So I felt that that exhibition was really successful, because not only had I worked with scientists and sleep doctors talking about sleep, but I also had a very strong patient voice about, or people voice, about what sleep means to individuals, because every experience is someone's experience.
That sounds absolutely incredible. I would say, like, your works literally flatten out a person, referring to your prints and your works on paper like that. In your epilepsy series, you spread out the thoughts, the body, and the perception of the self of your sitters. And the way you look at people to understand them seems medical, almost forensic, archaeological as well, and poetic too, I would say, at this point. How do you feel, and how do you see yourself when looking at somebody else's mind?
Three big epilepsy portraits, which I think you're talking about, that were in the National Portrait Gallery a few years ago, they came out of a commission I had to do some work about epilepsy. I met three really interesting people who had epilepsy. Elizabeth, who was a police woman, Fiona, who was an editor, and Max, who is a writer. And I interviewed them in great depth, because it seemed to me, again, I wanted to understand their epilepsy. And I made these gigantic portraits of them, which brought in, as you talk about very forensically, it brought in their brain scans, their EEGs. It brought in their particular emotional states. For instance, Elizabeth wanted to have a baby, and she realised that the medication that she took for epilepsy is really brutal and damaging to the embryo. And so I put her face in her womb, because I felt that that's what she was thinking about. And then Fiona, one of the other people with epilepsy, she thought that she couldn't tell a lover that she was epileptic, because they'd never want to be her boyfriend. So I put her face in her heart. And Max was writing a book on Magna Carta, and I just took some he was a very sort of spiritual man, completely brilliant and completely at terms with his epilepsy, although he did say to me that he'd be happier not to have epilepsy than to have it. And then the other thing that I did when I was making those three portraits, which might answer your question a bit, was that whilst I was playing with all the different shapes, and I realised that it was my interpretation of them, which I think is very important for an artist to realise when they're doing these sort of rather challenging portraits. So I happened to have some brain scans of my own brain, so I wove them amongst the pictures as well, because I didn't want to say in these portraits, this is who they are, because I was talking to them in a moment of their life when they were hung up on particular things. But I also recognise, not only is a body ageing, so whatever moment in time it's a philosophical thing, whatever moment in time you make a portrait of someone, they're different. The next day they're different, the next week they're different. And so I think I wanted to reflect that serendipity of catching that one moment of them in a portrait. So as an artist, I suppose I stand in that sort of tension, a philosophical tension of realising that we live moment to moment, and that nothing is solid and nothing is forever, alongside also wanting to give people a voice who don't have a voice very often. I mean, epilepsy is a very secret illness. So it was very interesting working on those portraits.
I'm guessing finding yourself in that place also implies having some kind of detachment towards like your practice as well. Otherwise, there may be some kind of overwhelm.
Yeah, I keep... There's lots of different things I think about these, and some of them are ethical. When you work very closely with your sitter, you also have to respect their space, and you're asking them to open up to you. But you have to be very clear that you're not. You might end up friends, but you're not offering friendship. You also have to give them the right to withdraw their permission for you to use this information you're giving them. So it's quite, you do have to be quite detached, but also I think going back to this sense of empathy, you also have to try and understand, you have to look at yourself critically, what you're doing and how you're using the situation to get the information from people. But I feel you have to be totally open and honest about the fact that you're talking to them in order to make these pictures, and that they're the payoff for them is that they will be heard. I will give them a version of the portrait as a gift, as a thank you. And I can't take it on board myself because I would be overwhelmed, because I'm dealing with so many complicated conditions that people have, that I suppose in the same way a doctor has to detach in a way. Although I think that some clinical practice needs looking at. I think that you can be more empathetic and you can listen more. And I think a lot of historically, doctor practice of keeping too much of a detachment is not good for the patient.
Yeah, I agree with that, absolutely. Mm. And I was wondering, since your works carry so much of the sitter's personality, how does it feel to share space with the artwork that you're working on? Does the artwork have a physical presence? Is that an embodiment of their personality in some way?
It's interesting, that question. It's a question of process. I'm both a very technical artist and a very research-driven artist. So I do all the research before I start making. I might be doing drawings and sketches and experimentations in the studio, but then comes a point when I'm ready to go. And then process takes over. And so making the work is not an intellectual process. It's not really an emotional process, it's an artistic process. And I think these distinctions are really important in terms of making art, because art, I can make very complicated pictures while listening to Dickens on Radio 4, so that my intellect can be engaged somewhere else, even though I'm making... Those epilepsy portraits were 9 different pictures that tiled together to make one picture. So they took a huge amount of planning and making sure things worked together. So do I feel embodied in the work? I don't know. I think there is the interest is in the relationship between the research and the making. And there's a moment when I let... The research is all in my head, then I let go of it and I start making. I can't keep it all together at the same time, I think.
Do you feel the presence of the sitters in the artwork as you work on it, though?
I don't know if I can give an honest answer to that. I feel a presence in them afterwards when it's finished, and then I always show it to them, and that moment is always very delicious because you never know whether they're going to like it or not.
Oh, I can just imagine how nerve-wracking that moment can be.
It is. I don't know. I mean, they must be very present, because these are people I've spent hours and hours with, talking, photographing, listening to their deepest stories. So I think it's already there. So I don't think it becomes more so in the making, although I do feel a great sense of responsibility in the making. But I think, for me, process takes over when I'm making, and the emotions just are sitting there.
Would you say that your work is more existentialist?
I think very much so. I'm very interested in who we are, what makes us ourselves, a sense of self. So I studied philosophy before I studied art, and I'm very interested in notions of epistemology, what is conscious, what we are, what is the true nature of a person. So I have no I'm not doing medical illustration, and I don't care if my work is medically unsound. The work I did on schizophrenia, I deliberately chopped up the anatomy of a body and put it together in the wrong fashion because I wanted the audience to feel the uncomfortable sense of self that you might feel if you get schizophrenia. Mm. So I'm using the body often to explore, to get a reaction from the audience.
Because I'm guessing the body is more of a tangible object to look at, to retrace the works of the mind.
Yeah, and also we can scan it. And I mean, what's interesting about living at this point in the 21st century is that the body is visually permeable in a way it's never been before. I had a brain scan, I don't know, 20 years ago now, and I could, and I was conscious while watching my brain on a screen. So, I mean, that's philosophically is an unbelievable thing, you know, to watch yourself think. And to realise that you are just flesh and blood and process. And I'm interested in the inner and the outer. I mean, I think that most of us just think about the outer skin that we are, unless you're medical. But what I think is fascinating is the machinery that goes on inside the body. I did a project about hearts a few years ago, and I found out this fact that every mammal, if you live a normal length of life without any sort of chronic illness or trauma, your heart will beat a million times. So a tiny little mouse, his heart will beat really fast for a million times. And so maybe he'll only last for 2 months, but he would have had a million beats. And an elephant will have a bigger, slower heart, so he'll live longer than a human being. And that just seemed to me a marvellous piece of sort of engineering. I know, it's a lovely fact, isn't it?
I really didn't know how... I didn't know that.
I hope it's true. I mean, I haven't done... Experimentally, I don't know if it's true, but that's what I've read. And I think it's a really intriguing thing about... You know, I like isolating different body parts to think their function within the whole thing.
I saw an image of you holding a human brain.
Yeah.
How did that feel like?
Oh, that was emotional. There's an artist a conceptual artist called Helen Chadwick, who sadly she died in her early 40s, who's a complete hero of mine. And she did a self-portrait holding a brain years ago, and a pair of hands holding a brain, and she called it self-portrait. So when I was invited to the Hammersmith Brain Bank to watch a dissection, I asked if I could hold a brain. Both in tribute to Helen Chadwick, and then also because it felt really, you know, what a thing to do. It felt like a both a ghastly and a wonderful thing to do. And what was interesting is it was bigger and heavier, and I sort of felt that it turned from object, the brain, to subject, the person in my hands. So it was very tender, and it's the sort of thing I can still have a memory of in my brain of what it felt like to hold it in my hand.
That's absolutely incredible, like the tactile memory of holding the brain.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to imagine what kind of privilege must be to touch somebody else's brain. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I had this incident 20 years ago when I had my brain scan, when I'd collapsed with a suspected brain hemorrhage. And I can remember being in hospital. Fortunately, there was nothing wrong with me, but I was in hospital and this young surgeon came and sat by my bed one night. I was really ill. And he said... tomorrow we're going to scan your brain and the chances are you'll have to have brain surgery. And he went away again and I was in complete shock, and I just got obsessed with this idea of someone touching my brain. I could not bear it, this idea that these fingers might lift out my soul, as it were, from my brain. So anyway, I didn't have to have surgery and I was fine. But I think that that's also why that moment of holding the brain was so precious to me. And after I'd had after I'd been to the brain dissection, when they do a brain dissection, these forms of anatomy are very formal. And they cut the brain and they laid it out on a big silver tray in a very particular order. And it looked to me like a zinc etching plate. So I said to the head guy at the hospital, is there any way you could get me permission to print off a human brain? Because I'd been working a lot in sort of internal portraiture, and I thought it would be the ultimate portrait to actually print from a human brain. And I never thought I'd get permission, but he went to the ethics committee. And the deal was that by printing from a human brain with permission and with permission from the patient's family, it would encourage people to think about the human brain, and maybe more people would donate their brains to science, because it's very important to understand how brain tissue works. And I was given permission. I was allowed to print from a human brain for 2 days. I had to have the professor with me at all times. And I made, I think, the best series of work of my life, which are called Transients. They're a series of 6 etchings. And also there's a series of digital prints that came in this over those 2 days. And it was a very emotional, a very technically difficult, and I think the most profound work I think I'll probably ever make. It was a real privilege to be able to work with someone's brain in that way.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Just looking at your work just makes me think of like a brain trying to retrace itself in a way, trying to understand its own work.
Yeah.
Let's say an inside-out way of looking at the mind. And will there ever be a final step, or does the map have a chance to be ever completed, in your opinion?
No, it's such a good question. Can the mind ever understand itself? Does it ever want to understand itself? It's very, you know, it's that idea that you've got a consciousness looking at consciousness looking at consciousness. Well, I'm sure it's possible for a brain to dissect and understand itself. But if you think about us as human beings, we're such a huge mess. None of us are sorted out. We're all neurotic as hell, or bonkers, or depressed, or happy, whatever we are. We're so complicated, we can't even keep in control of our own emotions, let alone understand the emotions of others. And maybe the whole embodiment of the, you know, this particular brain in this particular body at this particular time, maybe philosophically it's just too much to understand. But it's interesting.
Yeah, I find there's like a certain beauty in not knowing, and almost like as if we are just supposed to witness the greatness of our minds, but never to fully comprehend it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, you know, I love scientists. I love the way they explore the world. I've just come back from a visit to CERN, and the physicists there, you know, their quest is to find out why life happened. I mean, that's big stuff, you know, and they do all these extraordinary things which I can't understand. But I love the human curiosity. It's the same thing I have in the studio with materials. I'm never, you know, I'm old and older artist now, but I'm still, I have 100 years of pictures left to do. You know, I'm never bored. I've always got something I'm working on. And, you know, the relationship between the research and the technique, and the technique is research too. You know, a picture has to be made. And for me, it's really important to make it in the best way possible, which means experimentation, exploring materials, taking risks, letting a bit of serendipity happen so you never know what's going to happen next. So I'm just a really lucky person. I can do what I like every day of my life.
That's incredible. Just wondering, is there a way for you to predict how the work is going to look like at the end of the process?
Yes and no. I always, my first ideas are never what happens in the end, but because I'm quite technical, I know how to use materials, so it's not without skill. But print, which is what I love most, is very serendipitous, because there are many different processes. There's making the plate, whether it be a cardboard plate or an etching plate or a lithographic stone. And all of these processes are slightly alchemical. They're slightly without, you know, it is a bit like making a spell. So you get all the ingredients together, you make the marks you want to make. On one day, the acid might be warmer than another day, so it will bite deeper into the plate, so you can't control that quite. You can try, but you might not be able to. Another day it's very hot in the studio, the ink is moving very fast. Another day it's very cold, the ink is very heavy and won't move around the plate properly. And then you put it into the press. Some days the blankets are more fluffed up than others, so maybe it's not pushing down so hard. And then the other thing is with print, it always comes out backwards. And however much I try, however much I plan it, I'm always surprised by the reverse image. It's always deliciously exciting. Sometimes it's a disaster and they get torn up and put in the bin, but sometimes it's better than I could ever imagine. So, you know, it's a matter of skill and serendipity and taking risks. I like my work to look as if it's just landed on the paper. So I don't really want to know what it's going to be like before I start.
Thank you so much for the wonderful explanation. So I'm guessing that's why you enjoy printmaking so much, and that's why it's your prime way to produce art. And yeah, I think you have answered all my questions.
Excellent.
I am, again, very grateful.
Thank you very much to Susan Aldworth and Ludovica Colaccino for this episode. If you want to get in touch, then you can email on info@westphoto.pictures. Thanks a lot for listening.